The following podcast contains coarse language, adult themes, and major plot spoilers. Listener discretion is advised. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another installment of the King Zone podcast, which is a spin-off podcast from the Super Podcast at the Super Network, which you can find at supermarcy.com. I am your host, of course, Super Marcy, or just Marcy, but I like to be super. And I'm joined with my co-host, the always terrible Mr. Bede Germain. Hello, Bede.
Hello, Marcy. How are you?
I'm not too bad. How are you?
Oh, not too bad, thanks. Just getting myself ready and prepared for the Melbourne International Film Festival in a few days, or at least by the time this episode has already been put online, I'll probably already be neck deep into the festival. So that's what I've sort of been doing the last few days, and just getting some last minute bits and pieces done before that starts.
Yeah. I have come down with a cold or something, so hopefully I'll be better for the festival. At least I can see a few movies. And it is a little bit exciting, the Melbourne Film Festival, because my sister has two movies playing at the festival, which are The Nightingale and Little Monsters. So that'll be really cool to have a chance to finally see those movies. And, of course, you're coming with to see these movies.
Oh, of course. I wouldn't miss these ones for the world. And both of these films are definitely up there, at least on my personal list, as my most anticipated for the festival this year. So, and they're both two completely different films, which is great in terms of, like, the content. You got one that's more The Nightingale, which is more sort of this sort of dark sort of rape revenge film set in a... that's, you know, set in our Australian historical past, while you got Little Monsters, which is more of a sort of horror comedy that deals with zombies, which is sort of complete polar opposite ends of the spectrum in terms of films, but I'm just excited to see how both turn out.
Yeah, they're definitely very different, so it should be interesting to see how they are. And considering The Nightingale has had some walkouts, I guess we'll see if there's any walkouts at the session we go to.
Exactly. And it'll be interesting to see if people, because, you know, from what I hear, it's pretty full on in terms of the where it explores with its story, but it'll be interesting to see how the audience reacts to it. Will there be walkouts? Will people kind of embrace it? I guess we'll just have to wait and see, I suppose.
Yeah, should be quite interesting. So yeah, we have quite a bit coming up. Yeah, so our listeners might have noticed it's just the two of us for this episode. Yeah, so I'll just run down what we've done so far with the King Zone podcast. So our first episode was all about Carrie, which covered the three adaptations of the Carrie movie, which included one TV movie, which we had Sam Inglis with us for that one. And then in episodes 2 and 3, we covered the original Pet Sematary and this year's remake, and we also covered Creepshow and Creepshow 2, and both of those episodes we had Rob Hunter and Matt Konopka as our guests. So if you haven't listened to those, please by all means go back and check them out. And yes, for episode 4 it is just the two of us, which is a bit of a change of pace with the King Zone podcast. Yep. As future episodes, we will more than likely have guests for almost every episode. And without making our listeners wait too long, we will be discussing two films for this podcast. And they just happen to be Stephen King adaptations that feature Drew Barrymore. So we will, of course, be talking about 1984's Firestarter and 1985's The Cat's Eye.
Yep. Which I'm both really excited to talk about, because I'm having rewatched both of these films recently, and I haven't seen either for a while, so it's been interesting to kind of do a bit of a recap on both and actually talk about them for the show, because I don't think both films are probably on a lot of people's lists when it comes to their favorite Stephen King adaptations or some or his other work. But I think there's a lot in both of these films that at least is interesting enough to talk about.
Yeah, there's quite a bit to discuss. So we will start off by discussing Firestarter.
Charlie McGee is a healthy 8-year-old girl, normal in every way.
Charlie, now watch what you're doing.
But one.
Did she do that? What are you going to do with her?
I'll bring her here so you can do all your tests. And you give her to me.
Charlie has the power.
Do something bad. Will you still love me?
She can set things on fire.
Something's happening in there.
With just a glance. It is a power she does not want.
Stick with him.
Daddy, I'm scared.
So am I, honey.
A power she cannot control.
Back up.
And each night, she prays to be just like every other child.
We haven't got her yet.
We have.
But there are those who will do everything in their power to find her. To control her.
Charlie!
And maybe destroy her.
Charlie!
Come to me, Charlie.
Go!
You're gonna have to burn it down. I mean, burn it all down.
Charlie McGee is Stephen King's Firestarter. Will she have the power to survive?
As it did come out first, being that it was from the year we're born, 1984.
Which is a great year, by the way.
Yes, because we were born that year. I mean, no, we were born like 21 years ago because we're really young.
Exactly. We're young. We're still 21, even over 3 decades later, to say.
Yeah, just saying. yeah, so Firestarter. The short synopsis. The short synopsis is a couple who participated in a potent medical experiment gain telekinetic ability and then have a child who is pyrokinetic. And if you don't know what pyrokinetic means, pyro means fire. So she can start fires. The film was directed by Mark L. Lester, based on the book by Stephen King, and it stars David Keith, Drew Barrymore, Freddie Jones, Heather Locklear, Martin Sheen, George C. Scott, Art Carney and Louise Fletcher.
Indeed. I had forgotten, Marcy, no joke, when, like, because, you know, when I think of Firestarter, I think, you know, David Keith, Drew Barrymore, George C. Scott and Martin Sheen, but I forgot who else was also in this movie. I mean, I forgot, you know, Art Carney and Louise Fletcher, who are both Oscar winners, are in this film. And even Heather Locklear, I completely forgot about, was in this movie.
Yeah, I completely forgot. She doesn't have a big role, but she does have a bit part in it, and it's definitely weird to see her in this movie because I completely forgot she was in it.
No, I know. Even when her name came up in the credits, I was like, wait, Heather Locklear was in this movie? I completely forgot about it.
Yeah. So I haven't read the book, Firestarter, so I'm not sure how accurate it is or not accurate, however you want to say it. I do remember there was some kind of miniseries follow-up called Firestarter Rekindled that was on the Sci-Fi Channel. We won't be discussing that, but yeah, it's another one that had a TV or a follow-up that probably people don't really remember.
Yeah, it was weird because, like, I remember seeing the miniseries, or at least on video, in the when it came out, and I just sort of thought, well, at the time I knew a Firestarter, but I hadn't seen it. But even then, I was like, why would they make a sequel to Firestarter? And it was weird because even seeing the cast, you had like Malcolm McDowell and Dennis Hopper in the movie as well. But to me, it was kind of like one of those, like, you know, mini series or direct to video films that are basically just trying to capitalize on the first film. But but even then, though, like, you could, watching, you know, Firestarter, it's like, I it's definitely for me not one of my favorite films based on King's work. But I think for what it is, I think it's still a pretty solid adaptation, because I think what makes this one different, because even though it is a horror film, it's kind of more sort of sci-fi horror, and And kind of watching it, you basically have this father and daughter, played by David Keith and Drew Barrymore, who are on the run from this organization called The Shop, and who did experiments on David Keith and his wife, played by Heather Locklear, who, even though she's only, the reason she only has a small part is that she's killed off in flashbacks. And we will spoil both movies for this, just to let the audience, our listeners know. But so they're on the run, but the shop wants to use them for experiments for military purposes, particularly with Charlie, since she is the product of two people who were more sort of like experimented on, like what happened, how they use their powers is different from Charlie, who just seems to control her powers with much more ease. While David Keith, on the other hand, every time he uses his powers, it looks like it's the most painful experience of his entire life. And it's just pretty much, at the end of the day, it's kind of, to me, it's a story about a father and his daughter and their sort of relationship with each other. And we talked about this in, you know, in the previous King Zone episodes, how Stephen King finds something we can all relate to, whether it's like a personal experience or relationship with someone that we know, and uses that as the basis to tell this much kind of more complex or terrifying story. And I think, and he does that, and at least this film, I mean, I haven't read the book either, so I can't really say how it compares, but at least in terms of the film, I think it, the father-daughter relationship is the heart of the film.
It definitely is a movie about a father and daughter, just with all these other elements thrown into it. And it kind of, sorry for all the umming, trying to gather my thoughts. So it kind of, in a way, goes a little bit hand in hand with Carrie, with the abilities. Yeah. And that they do have some sinister consequences, as you see, as the movie goes along. But one of the interesting things I liked with the movie is how Andy and Vicky, which is David Keith and Heather Locklear, they meet while participating in this experiment, and they get their telepathic abilities, whatever you want to call it. Yeah. And they sort of fall in love, and then the child that they have ends up having pyrokinetic, which is a different ability. So it's kind of mutating in a way. But it's interesting to see them, or rather, you more see Andy use his abilities. And it's sort of, when he uses it, it gives him nosebleeds, which are meant to kind of be minor hemorrhages, I think. So the abilities do come with the downside, but we see that this doesn't happen with Charlie, who's Drew Barrymore in the movie. So these kinds of things are interesting, and obviously, you know, when people have these kind of powers, like, it's very obvious that the government wants to, you know, use these abilities for a weapon. And this is something that Andy doesn't want to happen to his daughter, so these two have been on the run trying to avoid them. And then during the course of the film, they obviously get captured, and the movie takes a bit of a different, I guess it's got a bit of a different feel to it, where father and daughter are now separated and more sort of experiments happen, which really gives us a lot more screen time from Charlie Sheen and George C. Scott, where George C. Scott's character kind of does this sort of role where he wants to trick Charlie into trusting him, and he obviously has his own his own intentions her.
Or ulterior motives,
So there's also that. So there's a little bit going on. So it's sort of changes tune about halfway through. So it's kind of like them on the run and then them captured and what's going to happen. I hadn't seen this movie for a while, and I really didn't remember much of anything with the movie. So, yeah, it was almost like watching it for the first time. And look, overall, it's not a bad movie. I think some of the more negative critic reviews are a little bit too harsh, because it is entertaining, it is interesting. I just found that it could be a little bit bland at times.
Yeah.
I'm not sure how you felt about that.
Yeah, well, I think, I think for what it is, like I said before, it's a really solid film, but I can't help but feel like they could have done more to it, especially with the concept of, you know, these people who were given, you know, telekinetic powers, or in the case of Charlie, born with these sort of pyrokinetic powers. And, like, we don't... I kind of wish the film kind of delved into more of that, because there are, like I said, interesting aspects to it. And I think, because the movie's about an hour and 50 minutes long, but at times the pacing can be a bit sluggish
as yeah, well. The pacing is very all over the place, which makes it a little bit sort of bland at times. And I think what would have helped a lot, because the relationship of father and daughter is, you know, key to the movie, there really needed to be a lot more development with those two characters, rather than they just have these abilities and are on the run. We don't really get to know who they are. And I think if we sort of got a little bit more in there, it would have been a bit more interesting to be following them. And again, some of the other scenes later in the movie just kind of drag on a little bit. They're not terribly engaging.
Yeah, I agree. It's... like I said, yeah, it just needed that sort of more of that dynamic between David Keith and Drew Barrymore, who I think are pretty solid in the film. Like, they do have, there are some of the acting at times, like, even though I think pretty much nearly everyone is solid in their roles, but there are sometimes they can get a little, either a little too over the top, or can come off as a little wooden at times, depending on what scene they're in. And some of the characters, like, can be underdeveloped as well. Like I said, R. Carney and Louise Fletcher are in this film. They kind of play this sort of older married couple who Andy and Charlie run into while they're on the run. And they're only in the movie for like a couple minutes, and then they're gone, and they don't really sort of show... I mean, they don't really come back into the film till like literally the last few minutes of the film. And I feel like they are kind of underdeveloped, and it's kind of like when you have two Academy Award winners like R. Carney and Louise Fletcher cast in these roles, you could have done a bit more to those characters, or maybe even develop more of the relationship between them and Charlie and Andy, or even just with Andy and Charlie being at their farm.
Yeah, see, I think they should have had a little bit more at the farm, especially when at the end of the movie, Charlie goes back to them.
Yeah.
So I think we needed a bit more development there. I thought the performances overall were pretty solid. Like, David Keith is pretty good, and he usually is pretty solid. Drew Barrymore, I think for me, was a little bit hit and miss. Like,
yeah.
She's definitely one of the better child actors when she was a child. But yeah, there were times where she wasn't overly convincing. I don't know, it's kind of hard to explain, but she was kind of a little bit hit and miss.
What have you done to my father?
He's resting, and he's fine, just like you. And he knows you're all right, and he sends his love, and he wants you to cooperate with us.
You're a liar!
Now, what kind of talk is that from a nice little girl like you?
Go to hell!
Martin Sheen didn't really have a lot to do.
Yeah, I know. You know what's funny? Yeah. You know what's funny? I texted you this, I think, last night. And I think first time I watched Firestarter, and even in the lead up to watching it, I kept thinking that Martin Sheen was still playing the same character that he played in The Dead Zone. Because both these movies came out, I think, a year or two between each other. And I just kept thinking, like, is he playing the same character in both? I was like, no, it's two completely different characters.
Yeah.
But he kind of plays them very similarly, but... In a way.
He sort of has a lot more to do in The Dead Zone.
Oh, yeah.
So if you want to see Martin Sheen act really well in a Stephen King movie, watch The Dead Zone, which we'll discuss in a future episode.
Indeed.
But I thought George C. Scott has quite a lot more to do in this movie, and he's actually really, really good. And considering, because his character sort of has scarring on his face, and he had to wear like a contact lens on one of his eyes. And during filming, I think it became infected, so he had to wear an eye patch. So there's a few scenes in the movie where he's actually wearing an eye patch, and then later on it just disappears.
Yeah.
But he's given, like, more screen time. He's kind of a sinister character, and we don't really know too well what his intentions are with Charlie in regards to using her powers. But he does get a bit of screen time with Drew Barrymore, and they actually have, like, interesting chemistry, and they worked well together, just like David Keith and Drew Barrymore worked really well as father and daughter. So I'd say, for me at least, George C. Scott was probably the best actor in the movie.
Yeah. Like, it's a very understated villain performance. Like, he's not playing it over the top or being showy. Yeah. He's just playing it very quiet. Like, even the scene, like, because there's a scientist, one of the main scientists who was involved in doing the experiments on Charlie's mum and dad, played by Freddie Jones. He's only in the movie for a little while, too. And then sort of, like, there's a scene that's actually kind of unsettling. It's like he's asleep and then he wakes up and he sees George C. Scott's character, who trying to remember his name, give me 1 second, Rainburn, just over him, and then he just sort of does this kind of almost like this kind of karate chop right to the face and just kills him instantly. But he doesn't do that. What he does in the film later on is that he does that to the nose so that the bone fragments within the nose will go straight into the brain and kill the person instantly.
Yeah, which he says he wants to do to Charlie.
Yeah.
But we can't work out if he thinks he's going to gain her powers. It's sort of a bit weird.
Yeah, well, from what I read, like I said, I haven't read the book, but from what I have read and researched, that the character of Rainbow is actually Native American in the original novel.
Oh, okay.
So that will kind of explain it. So it's weird. This is like the second Kingzone episode where we're talking about a white actor playing a Native American character.
Yeah, because you can see King he sort of adaptation. Does wear some of the Native American, like, costuming.
Yeah.
In this, so yeah.
It's kind of weird. I'm not sort of being, like, you know, I mean, outrage. I just think it's kind of interesting that this film went in that direction. Like, if it was done today, I could see, you know, a Native American actor playing this part now. But yeah, it's kind of interesting. This is like the second film in a row for the show that we've talked about a Caucasian actor playing a Native American actor.
Yeah. At least George C. Scott, like, is pretty good in the movie.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And, like, it's easy to see why Drew Barrymore had, you know, she got a lot of film roles when she was younger.
Yeah.
Because she does have, like, she had a really good look about her. She was quite a cute kid. And I think everyone adores her performance in E.T. I just think here she was very uneven, but I can imagine that this kind of role for a child would have been very challenging. So it's kind of easy to see why it's a bit up and down. But she does what she can do for, you know, someone of her age, which is commendable. But yeah, like, just looking at some of the critic responses were quite negative when this came out, and like Roger Ebert said it was boring, and no one was convincing. I disagree. Like, there are times it does drag on, it's a bit bland, but I wouldn't say the whole thing was really boring. There's a lot of things that are interesting and do engage you in it. And he also said we don't really feel sorry for Barrymore because she's not developed. And I do agree to an extent that Charlie's not really developed, but I think the way she actually plays her, you do feel quite sympathetic towards her because, A, you know, she's a child with this massive power, and B, all these, you know, government agents are after her to do experiments on her. So I think it's easy to kind of be sympathetic towards her. Even after we do see her burn alive a whole bunch of agents, but anyway.
Yeah. I think, at least in other aspects of the film I really like, I think Mark L. Lester, who directed the film, did a really good job directing-wise, particularly sort of the pyrokinetic set pieces, especially the very last half of the film, which, kind of funny now, like, did remind me a lot of Carrie in a lot of ways. And which I don't know if maybe this is like when Stephen King wrote Carrie, he thought, oh, I might explore this idea a little bit more in another book or something. Or maybe it's just coincidental. But I mean, Firestarter and would make an interesting double feature with Carrie because they do deal with similar aspects.
Yeah, whereas Carrie was more about like the mother-daughter and the daughter sort of being in high school. This deals with, you know, a kid who's much younger, but she's with her father. So they're sort of like, yeah, different fragments of the same thing, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And I'm looking at Drew Barrymore, I could totally buy her as the daughter of David Keith and Heather Locklear because she does have kind of similar features to both actors, especially Heather Locklear.
Yeah, I think it was well cast in that regard because they do seem like a family. And as I said, there was good chemistry between Drew Barrymore and David Keith, so they were quite believable as father and daughter.
I also love the score by Tangerine Dream, which is just phenomenal.
Yeah, it's a really good score. I think it's a little bit underrated in some ways because no one really talks about how good the soundtrack is, or at least I haven't noticed it.
Yeah, but it's like when you listen to it, like the music just really sort of adds a lot to the film. Like not only does it sort of brings, you know, an atmosphere to the film, but it brings, you know, a lot of intensity, but also kind of sort of melancholy and somber aspects to it as well. But I think it's just a really well done score, and it's quite beautiful at times too. At times it kind of almost sounds a little bit like a lullaby as well.
Definitely. It's definitely well worth checking out for that as well.
Yeah.
Although, there's some interesting...
I was going to say, like, this is Firestarter, like having a father-daughter relationship at the center of it is almost like a precursor to Mark L. Lester's next film, which of course was Commando.
That is true.
Except it's not Charlie that's killing everybody, it's Arnold Schwarzenegger doing all the killing.
Yes, that is true. And that film also deals with a father-daughter relationship.
Actually, now that I think about it, there's similarities between both movies now that I think about it.
Yeah. I was going to say, there's some interesting notes on the production of this movie where John Carpenter was offered to direct the movie while he was making The Thing, and he had hired Bill Lancaster to adapt the novel, and Stephen King approved of that, but then Carpenter had hired Bill Phillips to write another screenplay that had Richard Dreyfuss in the role of Andy. But then when The Thing didn't perform financially at the box office, he was replaced with Mark L. Lester, and he brought in Stanley Mann to write the screenplay. So that was, I guess, from what it says it was a bit more closer to the novel, which is interesting. So yeah, I don't know how the movie would have been like if John Carpenter had directed it. That's kind of like a big what if scenario, but I find it interesting that was offered the chance to direct the movie, but then they pulled out because The Thing didn't do well financially. And the reason The Thing didn't do well financially was because it was up against E.T., which was the family-friendly movie.
Ah,
also starring Drew Barrymore.
Good point.
But Carpenter did eventually
get around to making his own Stephen King adaptation later on with Christine. I think it came out like the year before Firestarter in 83, I think it might have been, but I can't exactly 100% remember, so.
Yeah, I'm not sure exactly when that came out. I'd have to look it up. But yeah, just reading up about the movie, some of the little funny trivia items was like Drew Barrymore's mum thought that Drew looked like the girl that was on the paperback novel for Firestarter, and then she ended up playing the little girl in the movie. Yeah, and Mark L. Lester said that this was actually the most difficult movie he had to make.
And I can
which
see
I
that.
Find kind of interesting.
I can understand that completely, because that final action set piece is just fire everywhere. There's tons of explosions, and sort of watching the movie on Blu-ray, you know, in prep for this episode, you can, because Charlie, like, shoots a lot of fireballs in this finale, and you can see you can actually see the wire in which the fireballs are flying around if you look closely. But yeah, but I can definitely understand that, especially when any filmmaker who has to make a film that has fire built around it is always very difficult and dangerous. And I can understand completely why Mark L. Lester would say this is like one of the most difficult shoots he would have done, for sure. Just based on the fact that just in this last half alone, where it's just fire and explosions everywhere. Actually, one of my favorite sequences in the film is the first scene where Charlie is getting tested by, you know, Martin Sheen and his crew. So she does all the, you know, tests and everything. And then they're sort of discussing among themselves. And then she's gone. And they're like, so who's going to go get her? And everyone in the, station is like, like looking around, like, we're not going to get her, no. That scene just made me laugh, so.
Yeah, after she sort of did all the destruction and everyone's like, I'd rather stay behind.
Exactly.
Was pretty funny, but there's a lot of good effect. Well, I guess they were practical because it wasn't CGI or anything, so I can understand like having a lot of controlled fires and stuff. But I think towards the end when she's actually like blowing or throwing like fireballs, that was a bit CGI, but it just shows like the extent of her powers are pretty strong, and they probably hadn't even really been tapped into it as much as they had been. So yeah, it's kind of a really good and action-packed climax to the movie.
Would you say that this is one adaptation that could use a modern update? Or is it a bit too like, because now we're in the sort of the age of superheroes and all that, and we have seen movies in the past 10 or so years that have had this kind of similar premise. I mean, one that comes to mind is the Chris Evans kind of superhero or superpowered human film Push kind of has a somewhat similar premise to this. So I'm sort of thinking, remake it or not.
Yeah, I mean, we are in the year of Stephen King movies because we've had a new Pet Sematary. We have It Chapter 2. We have Dr. Sleep. I think there's more that I'm not even thinking of that are coming out. So last couple of years, there's been quite a bit. So, it could benefit from something new, but I'm not really sure. Like, I don't know how you could add something new to this that we haven't seen before.
I could see this work. Even though there was a TV sequel miniseries, I could see this being done as a TV series.
You could actually do like a TV movie or miniseries, or even like an actual like TV show, like they kind of did with The Dead Zone.
Yeah, exactly. Because this one has a premise where you can easily do that. Because, I mean, you could start off with the parents getting together, then doing the experiments, and then a few years later they have Charlie, and then you can follow Charlie and Andy on the run. And you can easily do a whole season or maybe a few seasons on that, and then eventually get captured by the shop.
Yeah.
Maybe what happens to Charlie after she escapes and her dad dies.
Yeah. There could be like many different ways you could go about it, I think. Whether that happens remains to be seen.
Exactly.
But
before we move on to our next film, I would introduce a new little quick segment for our podcast. Like, there have been so many film and TV adaptations of Stephen King's work. I'm interested to know what Stephen King himself thinks of some of these works. So I did find a quote on when he was asked on what he thought of Firestarter. This one comes from 2012, and he said, "One of the worst adaptations of the bunch, even though in terms of story it's very close to the original, but it's flavorless, like cafeteria mashed potatoes."
That's pretty hot.
Yeah. And it's funny because he says in that quote, like, it's, and what you were reading from the trivia before, that this one's very close to the original novel. But I suppose I can see, like when we were talking about before, like either some of the relationships weren't really explored enough, or some of the pacing's a bit sluggish, or some aspects of the story could have been developed more. So maybe that's kind of what he's referring to. Like, if those aspects while also being closer to the original book, maybe it would have been an even better film.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. So what would your score be for Firestarter?
I'd say it's about a 3 out of 5. Like, I think it's definitely not one of the best Stephen King movie adaptations, but I think for what it is, I think it's just a solid and enjoyable one.
Yeah, I'd probably give it 3 out of 5 as well. I did enjoy my watch of it, so yeah.
Exactly.
All right. Do you want to introduce the second film we'll be talking about?
Indeed. And the next film we're going to be talking about, and of course the second in the Stephen King Drew Barrymore duology of films, and of course is the 1985 Stephen King penned anthology film Cat's Eye.
Stephen King, your favorite novelist and master of modern horror, has written his first motion picture screenplay. It combines all the elements of his creative imagination. Lovable pets. Classic cars. Quiet evenings. Favorite films.
Kill the son of a...
Good idea.
Adorable kids.
Help me! It's after me!
And of course, a monster or two. Experience a series of electrifying adventures as seen through Stephen King's Cat's Eye.
Where's your sense of humor?
Stephen King's Cat's Eye,
which is an anthology film, of course, that tells 3 stories, 2 of which are actually adaptations of Stephen King's short stories, and 1 anew, which the stories of which were Quitters Inc. and The Ledge, and as well as 1 3 original story called General, which is an entirely, like I said, an original sort of story that was written for the film, but it's also used this kind of wraparound story. But compared to, say, something like Creepshow, which we talked about in the previous episode, Creepshow 1 and 2, where they basically had 1 story, had a bit of a little sort of animation sequence, and then went straight to the next story. This one wraparound actually follows a cat who later in the film is called General. And he's sort of like this sort of stray cat who's wandering around the streets. And then one day while passing a window, an image of Drew Barrymore calls to him saying that she needs his help. So basically after seeing that, the cat sort of heads off on this journey. And during the course of the film, he gets involved with these other stories. Like he just sort of, like he either gets captured or just gets involved with these other stories that, and then eventually once they finish, he sort of leaves and then goes on to the next one eventually until he gets to the 3rd and final story, which is where he's kind of the more central character. So basically, like I said, it starts off with him getting Drew Barrymore's message, I think sort of like as a vision of what's to come. And so he heads off, and then along the way, he almost gets run over by a car where he gets picked up by... Actually, before he does that, what the movie starts off with is that it starts off with almost like a bunch of Easter eggs from previous Stephen King adaptations.
Yeah.
Because this is like one where it's kind of knows it's based on it's where Stephen King's work actually is littered with so much Easter eggs, because as the cat's sort of wandering around, the cat runs into Cujo, the dog.
Yes.
And it is the same dog from the movie, which makes sense because the film is directed by Lewis Teague, who did direct Cujo. And and then eventually the cat sort of trying to get away from Cujo and also just gets run over by Christine the car. and then eventually he gets in a delivery truck and then heads off to New York City. And then once he gets there, he gets picked up by this man who takes him to a company called Quitters Inc., which, of course, is the start of our very first story, which stars James Woods, who plays this sort of, like, pack-a-day smoker, or multiple pack-a-day smoker, whose friend tells him, oh, you know, you you're smoking too much, you need to quit. So he sends him off to this company called Quitters Inc., which is supposed to be sort of this company that helps you quit smoking, but their methods of doing that are very extreme, to say the least.
To say the least, yeah.
And then, like, one of the things, like, James Woods, he goes in there, and the man who owns the company tells him that basically what they'll do is that if you, we want you to quit smoking, but if you pick, even if we catch you even smoking one little bit, we're gonna hurt your family. Like, in, and he shows as a demonstration this room that has an electrified floor, and the Cat General is in there, used as kind of show how serious they are. And then, of course, you follow James Woods through the story as he's being tempted to smoke in these different situations. And then, of course, it sort of takes a bit of a dark turn, to say the least. So, Marcy, what did you think of the beginning of Cat's Eye, and also the first short story, Quitters Inc.?
Yeah. Look, the way it starts off is actually pretty fun. It's funny to see all the Easter eggs. And we did rewatch this the other day, so it was fun to watch the movie with someone else and have a bit of a laugh while watching it.
Yeah.
And being that I'm someone who is a smoker and I don't really want to be a smoker, watching Quitters Inc. just made me want to smoke, which is not what should be the case. Because Quitters Inc., it basically just forces you to do something, and they have these very sinister methods. Mm. And when you're a smoker, the more someone tells you not to do it, the more you want to do it. It's reverse psychology. So it actually, like, infuriated me in a little bit. but it is quite a silly story, and it's not done, like, 100% serious. Neither is the whole movie, which makes it a lot more fun.
Yeah. Yeah, because there's a lot of sort of dark humor throughout this entire film.
Absolutely. So you find out that Quitters Inc. have someone, like, following the James Woods character to see if he starts smoking. And for some reason, his daughter is played by Drew Barrymore, even though she plays a different character later on. Mm-hmm. It's kind of funny. But they're like, Quitters Inc. like, we're going to do these things. And then you realize, well, they're pretty fucking serious about doing these things if you smoke. They really don't like smoking.
To the point, like, even if they catch you doing it, like, the more amount of times they're going to literally kidnap, like, they eventually just kidnap his wife and put her in that electrified room just to kind of, like, not only torture her as punishment for James Woods's wrongdoing, but also to kind of psychologically torture him, and also even make him more determined not to smoke.
Yeah, which is kind of messed up, but anyway.
Yeah.
I kind of think that's the point of the story.
Yeah. But we kind of do get inside his mindset of what he's going through, trying to not smoke, because there's a sequence in particular in the movie where he's at a party with his wife, and everyone in the entire party is smoking. Even the kids are smoking cigarettes.
Yeah. Yeah. Look, if I am lacking cigarettes and I really want a cigarette, your mind plays tricks on you that everyone's having cigarettes. So it does kind of feel like that. But it's like, yeah, even the kids are having cigarettes, and he's just, like, losing the plot, having all these, like, weird visions. And for some reason, there's a dude that looks like Pavarotti at this party.
Yes.
Which I think we talked about for, like, 20 minutes.
Exactly. But even there was, like, I think, wasn't there, like, a giant cigarette packet that just started walking around?
Yeah. it's pretty full on.
It is, but it's funny, though. But I think it's really James Woods' performance, because I think he's terrific in this segment, and he really sort of sells it a lot. And, like, he knows how to play it straight, but he knows to sort of bring a bit of humor to the part as well.
Yeah, this was back when James Woods was actually a decent actor.
And not a dickhead, so.
Yeah, and not creeping after girls that are young enough to be his grandchildren.
Yeah, but that's a whole lot. Exactly, but that's a whole different discussion altogether. But,
yeah. Well, it's a bit funny that his character is called Dick in this movie.
Yeah, exactly. The irony of it. But yeah. I really like sort of the the ending of this film as well. So he's gone through all this trouble, trying not to smoke, and he does a good job. He actually succeeds at not doing it. But then the doctors and the guy who runs Quitters Inc. sort of says, okay, you got to, now that you're no longer smoking, you got to do this. And we're also want to make sure you look after your weight, because one of the worst things that happens to people when they stop smoking is they gain weight. So you need to be like, keep this, your weight at this level. And they're like, oh yeah, well, and James Woods is like, oh, so what will happen if you don't? Oh, well, and they're like, oh, we'll just cut one of your wife's fingers off. So they're just laughing. And then he goes to this party with his friend, who at the very beginning was the one who said him, told him he should quit smoking. And they're at the party, but then they sort of cheers that they're, both of them and their wives sort of cheer that they're, that he's given up smoking. But then James Woods notices his friend's wife is missing a finger. So,
yeah,
which I think it's a really nice little way to sort of end this segment.
Yeah, it's like, they're not freaking joking. They will do that.
Yeah, exactly. And
it's like, all right, they make you quit smoking, but now you can't gain any weight. Like, well, frick's sake, go away.
But, well, that was where, I like I said, I enjoyed this segment. I thought it was a lot
of
fun. Yeah.
It was quite a fun segment.
Indeed. And once this one's finished, the cat general escapes from the electrified room, and he gets on, where does he go? Because I know he gets on.
I think he goes to Atlantic City somehow.
Yeah, I think he goes by boat to Atlantic City, from what I remember. And so he gets there, and then as he's trying to sort of cross the road, he's trying to get run over. But then he runs into, there's this sort of rich kind of millionaire who's there with his friends, and they see this, you know, general trying to cross the road, and they sort of start making bets whether he's going to make it to the other side or not. So general does, and the millionaire picks him up, and he takes him back to his motel suite, which it leads us into the beginning of our second segment, which is The Ledge. This one features, and I'm trying to remember, let's see, the billionaire is played by Kenneth McMillan, named Kressner, and of course is Robert Hayes, probably best known for a lot of people as playing the lead in Airplane, or Flying High as it's known in Australia, is playing a character named Johnny. And Johnny is actually having an affair with Kressner's wife, and they sort of try to make a bit of a getting away. So he's at the bus station with Kressner's wife, and he tells her, like, get out of town. I got to go back and get some money, and then we can start a whole new life together. But then as soon as Kressner's wife leaves, Johnny gets kidnapped by Kressner's goons and is taken back to his motel room. And Kressner offers him an ultimatum. Like, basically, he can't allow his, you know, wife just to leave with Johnny just willingly. So what he decides is, Kressner is a betting man, he makes a bet with Johnny that since they're on the very top floor of the building they're on, he says to Johnny, if you can walk out on the ledge of the building and walk all the way around and come back to back to their room, he'll let him and his wife go free. And I don't know about you, Marcy, but this segment was very intense, because the whole idea of someone what's great about this segment is that it puts you in the mindset of Johnny, that we're watching him as he's going around this building on a very sort of very narrow ledge and trying to make sure he doesn't fall to his death. And it's just intense. Like, even though you know that it's just a big set, and it's a pretty impressive set, because they kind of make it, do it in a way where it's all the buildings, surrounding buildings near the ledge are all down to a scale, and even like the ground level, which is probably close to where he is in real life, but it just looks so far away that you just kind of get a sense of vertigo and anxiety when you're watching this segment. And it just had me on edge, literally, while watching this segment. So how did you think about this segment, The Ledge?
Yeah, it wasn't too bad. It's not as good as Quitters Inc., but it's still fairly decent. Kenneth MacMillan is kind of really over the top as Krasner, which I think he's kind of meant to be anyway. But the scenes of Johnny going around on the ledge are pretty intense, quite scary, especially if you're scared of heights. And that little pigeon that keeps pissing him off when he's doing that.
Yeah, that's definitely, that's definitely the silliest aspect of this segment, because there's this, like, he's going around a ledge and there's this friggin' pigeon that won't piss off and it keeps, like, pecking at his foot the entire time. And it looks hurt because you actually see the blood coming in through his sock and everything because the bird just keeps pecking at him. But even then, it's like, it's still pretty intense. And when you think he's going to, like, have a rest or maybe try to climb in through a window, Krasner is always there making, egging him on to keep going, or even fire a hose at him or, like, scare him and stuff like that just to keep him going around and walking along that ledge.
I mean, even with all the distractions and fucking annoying pigeons, he still makes it all the way around. And I'm pretty sure Krasner did not think that was going to happen.
Yeah.
But then it sort of has one of those, like, messed up endings again, where even though Johnny won the bet and he's like, all right, I'll grant my divorce, blah, blah, blah. But then he kicks over a bag and it reveals his wife's severed head. So...
Yeah, that was pretty messed up. I only saw this film for the first time, like, a few years ago, and I completely forgot about that moment. And it kind of takes this already kind of tense but funny kind of segment, but takes a very dark turn all of a sudden.
Very dark turn.
But I think, I do agree that compared to Quitters Inc., this segment, even though I did enjoy it, isn't quite as good as that one, because I think, and I sort of mentioned this to you when we, after we watched the film, that this segment kind of reminded me a lot of the segment from Creepshow, Something to Tide You Over, which is also about a rich husband who finds out his wife's having an affair with another man, and he puts them in a situation where a life and death situation that they have to try to get out of for revenge. And it's kind of similar ground as that, but, you know, King's known to kind of do that time to time, making projects or books or that had very similar premises, but slightly tweaked in a way. But I mean, it's still a solid one. I think both Kenneth MacMillan and Robert Hayes were solid in their roles. And there are, like I said, some pretty intense sequences. And also the production and design is pretty phenomenal as well.
It's definitely really, really good.
Yeah, like, it's a fun segment, like, but I think of the three, I think it's probably my least favourite, but it's still pretty good, though.
Yeah, it's fairly decent. It looks good. I particularly like the very end where Johnny forces Krasner to do the same thing, but Krasner does lose his balance and he falls to his death.
Exactly. And he
and the cat has the last laugh.
Exactly, because, the cat's it for features a bit throughout the segment, and then eventually escapes and gets down to the bottom where he hides in the car, and then he just sort of sees MacMillan fall to his death. And then that's sort of the end of this segment, and then it goes into our third and final segment, in which General hops on a train. Jesus, cat gets around everywhere. To Wilmington, North Carolina. I'm surprised it's not Maine, given that it's Stephen King, but where he goes to this house where this family is, and their young daughter, played by Drew Barrymore, who's the, he discovers is the kind of the vision that he's been having of the little girl telling him to come and rescue her. So he goes to the house, and then throughout the first half of the story, you hear Drew sort of like saying that she's been, well, Drew Barrymore's character, Alicia, sort of saying that she's scared because there's a monster in her room and all that. And then you find out that there, I mean, the parents try to tell her, oh, there's no monster or anything like that. But they find out that there is. It's kind of like this little troll looking creature or goblin looking creature that for some reason wears a justice hat.
Yeah, I don't know why it wears a justice hat, but anyway.
But yeah, the creature sort of like goes in and tries to, throughout the story, try to steal I guess her life force through her breathing, which is kind of foreshadowed because her dad says earlier in the movie, because she, like, Alicia wants to keep the Cat General, but her parents are kind of against it, and even her dad sort of tells her about a story that his grandmother used to tell him that cats would sit on your stomach while you sleep and try to sort of steal your life, like breathe out your life. And I think that's kind of like that story, at least the myth of that, is because it's not really cats that are doing it, it's these little goblin creature things that are actually doing it. And I really enjoyed this segment a lot, and I think the performances are all really solid. Drew Barrymore, I think, is, compared to both this and Firestar, I think she gives a better performance
here. Yeah, I think she's a little bit better here, and I think the character's called Amanda, not Alicia.
Oh, okay. Oh, yeah, you're right. Sorry. I'm sort of looking at that, because there's like three different names on...
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, you're right. You're right. It's Amanda. Alicia's the daughter of James Woods' character in Quitter's Inc. Sorry, yeah. I apologize for that. Yeah, like, she's definitely better here, and also the parents, one of which, Candy Clark, plays the mum, and I'm not exactly sure who plays the dad, so forgive me for that, but but basically, like, she's really good here, and also the sort of the creature design of the little goblin creature. Or troll. Actually, it says troll, so it is a troll.
I'm just going to assume it's a troll.
Yeah, it's a troll from Norbog. That's just kidding. But yeah, so the little troll creature, I think, is a really cool and memorable looking design. And I also really like that the film, like, again, like with The Ledge, they go out with the production design, like they make sort of, they recreate Amanda's bedroom like humongous. Like, you know, with the troll, it's a guy in a suit who's doing it.
Yeah.
But they sort of create this giant set that sort of recreates her room, and everything looks large, and it makes it sort of very believable, and sort of composite Amanda into the scene and all that. And of course, you've got General, who's there to try to protect Amanda while she's asleep from this troll. And there are some pretty tense sequences in this one as well. But it is a lot of fun, and it's kind of just to see, like, you know, General just taking on this troll-looking creature.
Yeah, apparently cats and trolls are natural enemies.
Exactly. I mean, who would have thought?
Yeah. Yeah, it's a pretty entertaining segment. The troll thing, like, the way they did the troll is really, really well done. I don't get the justice app, but anyway.
Yeah.
But yeah, the mum in this segment just pissed me off, because she just hates this cat and blames the cat for everything the troll does, which just wanted to slap the mum. She even, like, takes General to the animal shelter to get killed, and I'm like, you freaking bitch.
Yeah, exactly. Like, if General got killed, like, her own daughter would have been killed by that troll, so.
Yeah. I mean, the final sequence with General versus the troll, it's actually really fun. It's quite entertaining. And then when the troll gets killed, he goes into, like, the fan.
Yep.
And when the parents actually see all the little the pieces of the troll, they actually believe Amanda that General was actually trying to help her. And I like the bit, like, right at the end where General sneaks into the parents' bedroom because Amanda's sharing a bed with them, and he climbs onto Amanda, and you think he's going to suck out her breath, but instead he just licks her face and she gives him cuddles.
Yeah, like, it's kind of an interesting little moment.
A little fake-out ending.
Yeah, because, like, how it's done, it's like you see his face going towards Amanda's, and it's done in slow motion, kind of similar to what the troll did earlier. And you kind of think, oh, maybe the dad was right. Maybe cats do suck the souls out of people through their breath. But it's like, no, it's just licking its face. And I think it's a nice little moment to end the segment on.
Yeah, it's kind of a little tease for that one. But yeah, look, overall, I think Cat's Eye is a fairly entertaining movie. I know they definitely tried to make all the segments wrap around together. It doesn't always work because they are, like, three very different segments, but I appreciate that they kind of had the cat going around to everything. I like that it doesn't take itself too seriously. It's just a fun anthology film. And because, you know, they're all sort of like half an hour each, it's an hour and a half long. It's sort of a good running time because they're, you know, nicely developed. They definitely don't need to be longer than they are. So I really enjoyed it. I think it's a fairly solid movie.
Yeah, I agree. And I like that it's very different from Creepshow as well.
Yeah, it's definitely very different from Creepshow.
Yeah, like I think because, you know, with Stephen King, like when he wrote Creepshow, I think he sort of did that in the style of the, you know, the classic EC comics. While this one, like any of these stories could have easily been put in Creepshow, but I think he does a different spin on them so that it does make they kind of fit more here than they would have in a Creepshow film. But I think, and I like the, like I said, the wraparound segment with the cat going from the, you know, from the one story to another, because like it does feel a bit uneven because you're like following this cat and all of a sudden you're just thrown into this other story and the cat's just sitting in the background waiting until he kind of goes off to the next story. But it still works, and like all the stories themselves are really solid. There's not really a bad one in the bunch. I think all of them are all really well done in their own way. And like we said before, at the end of the day, it doesn't really sort of take itself too serious, and it just wants to provide sort of a fun time for the audience.
Yeah, I think The Ledge is probably the weakest one, but in saying that, it's still a very watchable segment. And it can get very intense at times, but I think probably Quitters Inc. is the best one, followed up by General.
Yeah.
And then The Ledge, but they're all actually, you know, very solid. It comes together as just, you know, a good little anthology movie. So my rating for this would be 3.5 out of 5.
I'd say it's about a 4 for me. I mean, I really enjoyed this one a lot. Like, I mean, it's no Creepshow, but I think as an anthology film, it's pretty solid. And I guess in a lot of ways, it's still kind of pretty underrated because you never sort of hear cats like get talked about as other kind of classic anthology horror films.
It's definitely, I think Firestarter and Cat's Eye are definitely two that kind of go a bit more under the radar when it comes to Stephen King adaptations or Stephen King movies. Yeah.
But I'd say it's worth checking out. I mean, if you haven't, for our listeners out there who haven't seen Cat's Eye, definitely seek it out for sure. But if you're one of those people who has seen it but hasn't seen it for quite a while, I'd say definitely give it a bit of a revisit as well.
Yeah, I definitely enjoyed it more watching it again because I barely remembered it. So I was like watching it for the first time because it's definitely been at least 5 or 6 years since I've watched it.
Yeah, I think it's about a couple of years since I last seen it. And I think for anyone who's a Stephen King fan, like I said, we have all that kind of cool opening sequence with all the kind of little cameos from like some of the characters from other Stephen King works. And even in general, Stephen King's book, Pet Sematary, does make an appearance.
Yeah, there's a lot of Easter eggs in here, which is kind of funny. Like, it's good to actually try and find them all. And there's probably ones in there that we probably missed.
Yeah, exactly. Although it makes me wonder, because now we're sort of living in a world of movie universes, even though there is a Stephen King universe, particularly in with his books. Would you say that Cat's Eye, based on all these Easter eggs, is set in the same universe as Cujo and Christine?
Totally. it's a world where Cujo and Christine are actually best friends.
Exactly.
And General is actually the long-lost brother of Church.
Ooh. I like that. That's actually a cool idea.
Yes, I'm smart.
Actually, one of my favorite things about this film before we wrap up is the soundtrack. I mean, the score is really good, but I like the use of songs. Like a version of the Police's Every Breath You Take.
It's actually kind of very sinister with how it plays.
Yeah, well, when you kind of think about the song, it is kind of sinister because everyone thinks of it as kind of a love song. But when you like read the actual lyrics, it's actually a really creepy song. And it's used a lot in Quitters Inc. So it definitely sort of adds an interesting layer to that movie.
Yeah, especially when it comes up in General as well.
Exactly.
And I think I made a comment going, what the hell is this song doing on a little kid's
little record player.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think it's a, like I said, Cat's Eyes, a solid little movie, and everyone should check it out or revisit it if they haven't seen it for a while.
Yeah, look, I think both films are fairly solid, worth watching. Yeah, not too much to complain about. Probably still be a few years until I end up like revisiting them, probably, but yeah. They do have a decent rewatch value, so yeah.
Yeah. I couldn't find any quotes from Stephen King about what he thought of Cat's Eye, like, you know, in retrospect, so that's probably a good thing, I suppose, or nobody has asked him about it, but he definitely had some choice words about Firestarter, so...
Yeah, well, maybe he likes Cat's Eye, I don't know.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe because he's more personally involved in this one, because since he actually wrote the screenplay.
Yeah.
But we'll definitely bring this little segment back for future episodes, particularly The Shining, because we all know that Stephen King has a lot to say about Stanley Kubrick's The Shining.
That'll be a very interesting episode, because not only will we be discussing the movie The Shining, we'll be discussing the TV movie The Shining, which Stephen King had a lot to do with, but also the sequel Doctor Sleep, which is out later this year. So once that film comes out, we'll be recording that episode.
Indeed. And I can't wait to talk about that one because I know I have a lot to discuss. But that won't be for another few months, so I'm good. But we have other plenty Stephen King discussions to have in the meantime with future episodes. I'm not exactly sure what episode we're doing next, because we're not quite... We did have a set order, but I think we're sort of going to switch it around a little bit based on who's with... which guests who we have locked up for them are available. So
Plus... As more sort of more newer movies come out as well, the order kind of gets thrown around a bit. Because as I said, this year just has a lot of Stephen King movies coming out.
Yeah, because I know for a fact as soon as It Chapter 2 comes out, we'll definitely immediately do an episode on that, plus It Chapter 1 and the original miniseries.
Yeah.
And we do have guests lined up for that. And also I just read the other day that Netflix has another Stephen King adaptation coming out in October, which is In the Tall Grass. That's directed by Vincenzo Natali and stars Patrick Wilson. So we'll definitely do an episode on that, plus two other Netflix Stephen King adaptations, Gerald's Game and 1922, when that one gets released.
Yeah, so we'll definitely have a lot more to discuss. But yeah, as of now, you'll be able to check out the website and see... all the happenings at the Melbourne Film Festival, which starts on Friday, but this episode will be coming out maybe once it's started.
Yep.
And once we're finished with the film festival, we'll be getting back onto the King Zone. We will be debuting the Ozploit cast, and there will be much more of our mini podcast series, The Podcasters of Horror.
Indeed. In the meantime, like, if anyone wants to kind of follow us out there on the internet, you can find me personally at Twitter at twitter.com/BeJamine, or my fan page at facebook.com/TheTerribleAussie, and of course all my writings over at supermarcy.com with my columns, reviews, particularly Bad Movie Tweetathon, and as well I'll be doing a lot of, since Myth is coming up, I'll be doing audio reviews on all the films that I'm seeing, so I'll do like little mini 20 to 30 minute podcast episodes daily of everything that I've seen, with like 4 films per episode, so I can knock them out pretty quickly. And of course, you can also find my column Horror Down Under over at thescreamcast.com.
Yep. And you can find me on Twitter at twitter.com/supermarcy. You can like or join our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/thesupernetwork. You can join our Facebook group. You just look up The Super Network on Facebook and you can ask to join the group. You can follow our Super Network on Twitter at @SM_SuperNetwork. You can send us an email at thesupernetworksm@gmail. You can subscribe to us via iTunes or via Stitcher. And if you so please, you can look up The Art of MP on Etsy and see my artwork. And for the month of August, I will be taking part with my dog in Porgest, which is to raise money for guide dogs. And if you want to You can send a donation to us, which would mean a lot because the whole point is to raise money. So even if you want to donate $1, you can. You can go to paulgus.com.au/fundraiser/Marcella Papandrea, and that's our page. So you can donate. And with that, I think we are over and out.
Indeed. Well, thank you for everyone who listened to this episode, and keep a lookout very soon for episodes of King Zone, and as well as Podcasters Horror and all the other ones as well. So
yes,
we'll see you all later. See you, everyone. Bye.
See ya.
Charlie.